Thank you all for standing by, and welcome to today's conference call. At this time, all lines are on listen only for today's conference until the question and answer portion of our call, at which time you will be prompted to press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up during the Q&A portion of our call, and please be sure to record your name when prompted so that I may introduce you when asking your question. Our conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn conference over to your host, Ms. Kathy Harbin. Ma'am, you may proceed.
Thank you, Jill, and thank you all for joining us for the release of the CDC guideline for prescribing opioids for chronic pain. We're joined today by CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden, Dr. Deborah Owry, who is Director of CDC's National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, and Dr. Deborah Dowell, co-author of the guideline, are here for the question and answer session. In addition, we welcome the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, for opening remarks. I'll now turn the call over to Dr. Frieden to introduce Secretary Burwell.
Thank you and good afternoon. We're delighted that Secretary Burwell could join us today. 1 year ago, in March 2015, Secretary Burwell announced the HHS initiative to reduce prescription opioid and heroin-related overdose, death, and dependence. Secretary Burwell understands well the devastation that opioid abuse and overdose have caused for American families and communities, and has helped bring together stakeholders from across the government and across the country to focus on prevention, treatment, and intervention. Secretary Burwell.
Thank you so much, Dr. Frieden. The opioid epidemic is one of the most pressing public health issues in the United States today. Last year, more Americans died from drug overdoses than car crashes, and these overdoses have hit families across our entire nation, families who live on city blocks and families who live in rural towns. In my own home state of West Virginia, I have seen firsthand and continue to see firsthand how substance use can devastate families and communities. Combating the opioid epidemic is a national priority. That's why the President's budget requests more than $1 billion to fight opioid use disorder and overdose. And we look forward to working with the Congress to secure this funding. It's why governors throughout the nation are working from common ground to end this crisis. And it's why public health leaders across the country are finding innovative ways to push back against these troubling statistics and what it means to people in their everyday lives. At HHS, we're helping to lead the nationwide effort by focusing on three priority areas. First, we want to make sure that naloxone is in the hands of first responders and anyone else who responds to an opioid overdose. In November, the FDA approved a nasal form of naloxone, one of the more innovative ways to get this treatment to the people who need it most. We're also expanding access to evidence-based treatments like medication-assisted treatment, a combination of behavioral therapy and counseling with medication to treat substance use disorders. And last week, we awarded $94 million to medication-assisted treatment in 271 health centers across the country. Third, what brings us here today is our commitment to equip health professionals with tools they need to fight this epidemic. We need to help primary care providers make the most informed prescribing decisions, balancing the need to manage their patients' chronic pain with the duty to curb dangerous prescribing practices. That's why CDC is releasing their guideline for prescribing opioids for chronic pain. We believe this guideline will help healthcare professionals provide safer and more effective care for patients dealing with chronic pain. And we also believe it will help these providers drive down the rates of opioid use disorder, overdose, and sadly, ultimately, death. We know this is a goal that we all share. Patients with chronic pain should have safe and effective pain management, and too many families have had to come to grips with the tragedy of opioids, use disorder, and overdose. The guidelines CDC is releasing today will promote safer pain management while helping us reduce opioid abuse. It's an important step in our work to combat the opioid epidemic. With that, I will turn it back to Dr. Frieden.
Thank you so much, Secretary Burwell. It's become increasingly clear that opioids carry substantial risks but only uncertain benefits, especially compared with other treatments for chronic pain. Today and every day this year, more than 40 Americans will die from a prescription opioid overdose in this country. Beginning treatment with an opioid is a momentous decision, and it should only be done with full understanding by both the clinician and the patient of the substantial risks and uncertain benefits involved. We know of no other medication that's routinely used for a non-fatal condition that kills patients so frequently. With nearly 250 million prescriptions written each year, it's so important that doctors understand that any one of those prescriptions could potentially end a patient's life. A study in 2015 found that one out of every 550 patients started on long-term opioid therapy for non-cancer pain died of an opioid-related cause just a little over within 2.5 years of the first prescription. Remarkably, those who got the highest doses of opioids, more than 200 MMEs per day, had a 1 in 32 chance of dying in just 2.5 years. And while some opioids, potentially buprenorphine and others, may carry a slightly lower risk of dependence, almost all of the opioids on the market are just as addictive as heroin. And while it's important that abuse deterrent formulations be made more widely available because those formulations are harder to melt down and then inject, they don't prevent opioid abuse or overdose when taken by mouth. The bottom line is that increased prescribing of opioids, which has quadrupled since 1999, is fueling an epidemic that's now a blurring of the lines between prescription opiates and illicit opiates. I want to be clear that prescription opioids have an important place in pain management when the potential benefits outweigh the potential harms. Many Americans use prescription opioids for much-needed relief from pain, and evidence supports that opiates can be effective in the short term. They're important medications, for example, for patients in active cancer treatment or getting end-of-life or palliative care. But we don't have evidence to show that opioids can control chronic pain effectively over the long term, and we do have evidence that other treatments such as exercise therapy, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and a variety of other treatments and modalities can be effective for chronic pain with far lower risks. That's why today CDC is releasing the CDC guideline for prescribing opioids for chronic pain to chart a safer, more effective course. The goal of the new guideline is to help providers improve patient care and safety and prevent opioid overdose. The guideline reflects the best available research to date and will refine the guidance as new science becomes available. But the ongoing impact of prescription overdoses and the effect on American lives, families, and communities means that we have to act now. The guideline was developed to support primary care clinicians who prescribe about half of all opioid pain medications in relieving patients' pain, preventing patients' suffering, and promoting patients' well-being. This guideline helps by offering a flexible tool, not a one-size-fits-all tool, but a flexible tool to support informed clinical decision-making, encourage improved communication between clinicians and patients, and improve clinician confidence about when and how to use opioids to manage chronic pain. The guideline provides information about safer and effective options for pain management and encourages clinicians to work with other providers, including behavioral health specialists, pharmacists, and pain management specialists. The guideline is intended to address chronic pain, not acute pain, but we recognize, based on the feedback we got from doctors and others, that long-term opiate use often begins with treatment of acute pain, and the guideline suggests that clinicians prescribe the lowest effective dose of immediate-release opioids when treating a patient with acute pain and not prescribe more than is needed. 3 days or less will often be sufficient. More than 7 days will rarely be needed for most acute pain syndromes. The guideline is designed to help clinicians and patients together assess the risks and benefits of opioid use and identify the best treatment options. We worked to develop a practical guideline with tools and resources, including a decision checklist to help clinicians use the guideline every day. We want patients to understand the recommendations, so we created resources and materials for patients as well. The guideline has 12 recommendations based on three key principles. First, non-opioid therapy is preferred for chronic pain outside of active cancer, palliative, and end-of-life care. Opioids should not be the first-line treatment for chronic pain. They should only be used when their benefits are expected to outweigh their substantial risks. Second, when opioids are used, start low and go slow. Start with the lowest possible effective dose and increase only gradually. Third, always use caution when prescribing opioids and monitor every patient closely. Clinicians can minimize the risk to patients by taking actions such as checking the state's prescription drug monitoring program or having a plan to taper opiates if the desired response is not achieved. I want to spend a moment talking about the process of guideline production and preparation. CDC developed this guideline using a transparent, rigorous, scientific process. We obtained the best available evidence from anywhere in the published literature. We also involved more than 50 of the top experts in the world on various aspects of pain, addiction, and pain management to review the guidelines. We carefully read and considered more than 4,300 public comments, including letters from more than 160 professional, community, and advocacy organizations, and many individuals whose lives have been deeply touched by this issue. In the end, these are CDC guidelines, written by CDC staff, and CDC stands by them. In the feedback that we heard, we understood the importance of balancing the expected benefits and risks and how challenging that can be. Primary care clinicians reported concerns about training and other modalities for pain management. Clinicians and patients need to carefully weigh the decision to start opioids and proceed only when there's a full understanding of the risks and that the benefits are likely to outweigh the risks. Plainly stated, the risks of opioids are addiction and death, and the benefits for chronic pain are often transient and generally unproven. In fact, some of the literature that was shared to us in the comment phase outlined studies that suggest that individuals treated with opioids may actually experience more pain in the medium and long term than patients not treated with opioids because of potentiation of pain. Management of chronic pain is an art and a science. The science of opioids for chronic pain is clear. For the majority of patients, there are effective alternatives to the known, serious, and all too often fatal risks of opioids.
Thank you, Dr. Frieden. Jill, we are now ready for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Harbin. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please be sure to release your line so that you can record your name so that I may introduce you. Also, a reminder, please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up. Our first question is from Melanie Salzman with NewsHour. Your line is open, ma'am.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. My question is regards to the process. I know that you just addressed that, but I'd like to dive in more for a minute. Why was the process so complicated in being able to come up with a concrete, comprehensive set of guidelines? What went into that, and why did it take more than just, you know, a week or 2 weeks to really get those concrete 12 points?
I think there are several factors that go into the process. The first is that the evidence on treatment of chronic pain is not as robust as we would like. There are a limited number of studies that have looked at the effectiveness for long-term pain, and those studies have generally not found effective positive outcomes in terms of improvement in functioning or reduction in pain in the long term. Also, in the process, it's been very important that we involve a broad range of stakeholders so that we can get perspectives from patients, from families, from clinicians, and then accommodate and address the concerns that we have heard. So there have been both the need to make decisions based on the best available science and also the need to have an inclusive process of getting a wide range of comments to inform the final guideline.
And then I guess the follow-up would be in terms of making sure these guidelines are actually implemented, not only something that physicians can go to, but in a way that you're making sure they actually are looking at these guidelines. Is there a plan for doing that, both current practicing physicians, but also in med schools, looking at, you know, the future physicians in the United States and how they're being trained?
Well, first, to be very clear, we are not a regulatory agency. So these are guidelines. They're recommendations. States, the National Governors Association, healthcare systems, insurers may look to these guidelines when they implement policies within their own jurisdictions or institutions. But what our role is to provide the best available science to try to improve the care of patients who are suffering from chronic pain, which is a very challenging situation for patients to have to live with and a very challenging condition for physicians to treat.
Thank you.
We also, I will say, did work with others to develop a checklist for prescribing opiates for chronic pain. This is for primary care providers, and this and other tools will be part of the rollout process to be able to empower physicians to have this information at their fingertips.
So it's a suggested set of guidelines, but not something that's going to be a requirement for physicians to follow?
CDC does not regulate the practice of medicine.
Okay, thank you so much.
Our next question is from Dan Childs with ABC News. Your line is open.
Thank you very much for taking my question. I have one question and a quick follow-up. The question that I have is, you know, we have pharmaceutical companies, essentially manufacturers, being called out specifically in a JAMA editorial having to do with these new guidelines. So my question is, what part did, if any, did pharmaceutical companies play here as a stakeholder in developing these guidelines? And what is their responsibility going forward, seeing as there are many who believe that they hold a great deal of responsibility in terms of the expanded use of these drugs for those with chronic pain?
So we exercised a very stringent conflict of interest policy, whereby we did not involve in the drafting of the guidelines anyone who had a conflict of interest with the pharmaceutical industry or other actors in this topic. We certainly read and considered all comments received, regardless of where those were from, including some groups that are part of or associated with the pharmaceutical industry. I think we can take a step back and say that pain in general, and chronic pain specifically, is a very challenging condition to treat. And for many years, the status of medical practice in the U.S. was such that pain was not adequately addressed. And there are still patients whose pain is not adequately addressed. The challenge is when we generalize that situation to chronic pain in which opiates are of unproven benefit, we can get into really big problems because these medicines are so addictive and they are so lethal. I think some of the things the pharmaceutical industry has done include formulations which make it harder to melt down and shoot up these drugs. I do think it's important to be clear that these formulations, which are referred to as abuse deterrent, are no less addictive. And unfortunately, no medication has yet been discovered that can separate the pain-relieving efficacy of an opioid from the addictive nature of an opioid. And that would be a really great thing if a company can come up with that, because then you would have an effective pain relief medication that is significantly less addictive than heroin. But right now we don't have that. And in the interim, I think it will just be very important. And one of the things we heard from physicians was they wanted guidelines that were clearly non-conflicted, and that's what these are.
The one follow-up that I have is there any clue as to what proportion of the 250 million prescriptions per year are going to those with chronic pain, i.e. not those who are cancer patients or those who are taking them for palliative care?
Let me turn this over to Dr. Deborah Dowell. Dr. Dowell is the lead author of the guideline and has spent an enormous amount of work, probably understands the literature on this topic better than anyone alive. Dr. Dowell?
Okay. So in answer to your question, the literature supports that a minority of patients receiving opioids are receiving them for long-term use for chronic pain, about 5%. However, when you look at the amounts prescribed in terms of days, duration, for a majority of the amount of opioids prescribed, about 70%. They also account for a disproportionate amount of the adverse effects related to opioids. One study, a national VA sample, found that more than 70% of patients dying of opioid-related overdose who were prescribed opioids were being treated for chronic pain conditions. In addition, there's evidence patients who develop opioid use disorder who are prescribed opioids, a disproportionate amount of them are prescribed opioids for chronic pain.
So about 5% of patients accounting for 70% of these prescriptions?
Yes, and some studies have found that.
And this is one of the reasons why we have also addressed use of opiates to treat acute pain, because most of the treatment, most of the patients who go on to chronic pain syndrome start with an acute pain situation. Next question, please.
Our next question is from Robert Lowes with Medscape Medical News. Your line is open.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Dr. Frieden, there were strenuous objections to the initial set of 12 recommendations as regards to specific numbers on, for instance, you know, a dose threshold, 90 MME being something you should avoid, and the number of days that were suggested for the duration. And several medical societies said that they didn't want any specific numbers because there wasn't enough evidence. Yet the final recommendations pretty much preserve what was in the initial ones in regards to these specific numbers. So what went into the thinking? You had objections to numbers that doctors felt might constrain them and weren't evidence-based.
So I will say we did get a lot of comments in. We took them all seriously. We found many of them helpful. And between the earlier released version and the final, there are a number of refinements in the approach. That includes the two areas that you mentioned, involving lowest effective dose and shortest duration. We've provided a range rather than a fixed number. And I'll let Dr. Deb Howry, who is the director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, in which this work resides, comment further. Dr. Howry?
Thank you. And what I would say is there were comments on both sides. We had a lot of organizations that thought we should actually have lower dosages or shorter durations. So there was a balance of comments for both shorter and longer. With regards to the actual dosage, we try to provide more nuances, and you'll see that in the full document, mm-hmm. that at 50 we ask you to really carefully reassess the individual benefits and risks, and at 90 it's not a pure cap. Instead, we say you should carefully justify the decision, or, again, in the document itself it talks about referring to a pain specialist. When you do look at a lot of the emerging evidence, though, there is evidence of increased risk of overdose as the dose escalates. Providers did want a number in general to guide their practice. Again, this is guidelines, not regulatory, so this will help physicians in their daily practice determine what are safe dosages. And this is about initiation of opioids for these dosages. We feel strongly that you do not initiate an opioid-naive patient on a very high-level opioid because of the substantial risk of overdose. And as Dr. Frieden mentioned, we did provide a range, and that was a modification we did after the feedback for the acute pain recommendation. We think it's important that physicians always use the shortest course possible, but did want to allow more flexibility in that number.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question is from Randall Pearson with Reuters. Your line is open.
Yes. Hi there, Dr. Frieden. You know, I was just wondering your thoughts about common sense among the federal agencies, the FDA and the CDC. Or, you know, you mentioned that the prescriptions have quadrupled since 1999, leading to 165,000 overdoses. But should the FDA and the CDC have exercised more common sense in recent years? Have you let the cows out of the barn when you might have been able to constrain the situation earlier? For instance, Zohydro, an extremely potent opioid, was approved by the FDA, you know, fairly recently, despite what we know about the heroin epidemics throughout America and their links to opioids. So has the federal government really kind of lapsed in trying to be more proactive earlier to prevent this situation from being at this incredible degree?
Well, unfortunately, I think there's no quick fix for the opiate epidemic. We're seeing a situation in which a large number of people in this country are already addicted or dependent, and that involves both prescription opiates and illicit opiates, heroin and illegally produced fentanyl, among other products. And the challenge really is turning around our approach to pain management, understanding that the best treatment isn't always the one that provides the most immediate relief. It's the one that provides the best relief for the longest period of time. That's something that I think as a medical profession and as a society, we had insufficient recognition of, and we're paying the price, and far too many families and individuals are suffering or dying for that reason. So we can always look back and say something could have been done sooner or differently. Our focus right now is moving forward. What can we do to protect as many people as possible and prevent as many overdoses, deaths, and people who become dependent and addicted to opiates as possible going forward?
Should there be more stringent requirements in the future at the FDA, since we have this flood of drugs on the market which we can't control? Should the FDA be a little bit more vigilant or restrictive itself in putting yet more products on the market?
I think you'd have to address that question to the FDA. The FDA, by law, has to basically make decisions based on whether medications are safe and effective and equivalent to medications on the market. So there may not be a regulatory method for them to do what you're suggesting, and whether that would be advisable or not, I can't comment.
So is that
next question, please.
The next question is from Mehmet Oz with the Dr. Oz Show. Your line is open. Dr. Oz, your line is open for your question. Your line is open.
Shall we go on to the next question?
Moving on to the next question. It's from Kimberly Leonard with U.S. News and World Reports. Your line is open, ma'am.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. One of the items here on the guidance talks about using a urine test to detect whether patients already have signs of opioids in them, and obviously that's to tell whether they might be selling them and not using them, or if they already have it detected there. My question is, Is this something that physicians are already doing, or is this something that is new? And if opioids are detected, would a doctor then have enough information to say, we're not going to be prescribing this?
So I will turn this over to Dr. Dowell.
Okay.
So this CDC guideline is certainly not the first guideline to recommend this. That being said, we did find surveys that many physicians do not use urine drug testing in making decisions about prescribing opioids. And in addition to that, a couple of studies have found that physicians misinterpret results on urine drug testing. Urine drug tests can't tell you everything. They can tell you whether, in many situations, whether a prescribed drug is present and whether other drugs are present. They can't tell you, you know, anything about the dose. So the guideline does provide further guidance for physicians in interpretation of these tests.
Okay, thank you.
Next question, please.
Our next question is from Mehmet Oz with the Dr. Oz Show. Your line is open.
If you're speaking, we can't hear you.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, good. Sorry about that. For the average patient who hears all this news when they're offered an opiate by their physician, what do you recommend that they push back on? How would they phrase and articulate their reticence to take an opiate?
That's a great question. I'll start, and I'll ask Dr. Dowell to continue. I would first say, is this necessary? What are the alternatives? What are the risks? What's the dosage? Can you guarantee me that this is going to relieve my pain and not risk getting me addicted? Dr. Dowell?
I would agree with that 100%. I think the important questions are, what is this necessary? What are the alternatives? What are the risks? What are the benefits? And how long do you anticipate that I'm going to be taking this? One more I would add is, what do we hope to accomplish? What should be our goals in using this medication, and how are we going to know if we accomplish them?
And this is Deb Howard. Just to add, the first principle of our guidelines are about using non-pharmacological therapy and non-opioid pharmacological therapy. And I think, all of us speaking today are physicians who have worked in the field, and many of us didn't have a lot of experience with what are the non-opioid alternatives. So I think patients really need to ask their doctors, what are the non-opioid alternatives, and have a better understanding of how those can impact their pain directly.
And as a quick follow-up, you articulate, Tom, in your New England Journal piece, that we're prescribing an opiate per person in America. What's the goal? There's a discrepancy from state to state that's quite dramatic. Any idea on what you'd hope to see in 3 years, 5 years?
Really, what we hope to see is fewer deaths from opiates, from all sorts of opiates, both legal and illegal. That's the bottom line here. What we also hope to see on a more immediate basis is that some of the higher and more dangerous doses of opiates will be used much less. I was really stunned at the study that showed that one out of 32 patients died in 2.5 years from the highest doses of opiates. So understanding that these are really dangerous medications which carry the risk of addiction and death, and that we would at least begin to see that the prescriptions that are written are safer or less risky, at least. And ultimately, we want to see the number of deaths come down. It's just a horrific fact that we're seeing it continuing to increase. It's one of the very few trends in this country where health is getting worse. It's one of the very few things where we're seeing an increase in mortality rates. And we're seeing it across the entire lifespan, from neonatal abstinence syndrome to kids who get hooked on an opiate because of a sports injury and end up getting hepatitis C or HIV because they switch to injecting drugs, to elderly who have an increased risk of falls because they're on opiates. So it's a terrible problem that's going to involve all of us getting into a more appropriate place when we think about managing pain.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Charles Lane with the Washington Post. Your line is open.
Thank you. Listening to you speak about these prescription drugs, I'm just struck at the change in tone, the depiction of these as Dr. Frieden's own words, as a dangerous, quote-unquote, drug. It's far, far from what we were being told about them 15 or 20 years ago when they came on the market. So I'm wondering the following. A lot of people in the field believe there's pressure, has been pressure on physicians to prescribe these because they would get bad reviews on Yelp or because they're, the facilities that they work for would be thought of as neglecting pain as the famous vital sign. How will these guidelines and how should they affect that dynamic where there has been so much pressure on physicians, you know, sort of when in doubt, prescribe? How are you going to affect that dynamic?
When I went to medical school, we had exactly one lecture on pain. And in that lecture, the professor said, if you give an opiate to a patient in pain, they will not get addicted. It was completely wrong. But a whole generation of physicians went through training hearing that and also recognizing that pain was and continues to be undertreated in some situations. All of us have a role to play. I don't think doctors alone, I don't think patients alone can get us to a better place. When we've interviewed patients, we've heard consistently that they're concerned about the addictiveness and danger of opiates. When we've interviewed doctors, we've heard that they're concerned that patients may be rating them poorly if they don't provide pain medications or opiates. And we know that sometimes a few highly vocal patients may change the perception of a situation for a doctor. That's why we're emphasizing both the need to be careful with prescription of opiates and the need to scale up treatment of addiction, which is a serious disease for which there are medications such as buprenorphine and methadone which do improve outcomes, and that's part of this as well. I don't think there's a quick fix, but I do think that the solution is going to involve more than just doctors, more than just patients, to address the real concerns that people have about use and risks of opiates. Next question.
Next question is from Sabrina Tabernisi with the New York Times. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Dr. Frieden, I mean, is I know these are guidelines and non-binding, but I mean, it sort of sounds like you're saying, and here the kind of the federal government is saying, that the risks outweigh the benefits of these drugs for most patients. Is that, would you say that?
I think, again, this is not a cookbook. Clinical care is both a science and an art. And there are some patients for whom currently on opiates or potentially in severe pain for whom they may be appropriate. But for the majority of patients, the risks will outweigh the benefits for chronic pain for the vast majority of patients.
We have time for one more question.
It comes from Sarah Carlin Smith with Politico. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Sarah. Thank you for taking the call. At the end of the guidelines, and this question is directed to Secretary Burwell or someone at HHS if they're still on the call, you guys mentioned the need to work with other areas of the federal government on policies that could make these guidelines more practical for doctors to follow. Are there any plans, like for CMS or other agencies within the government, to change how you guys cover non-opioid pain treatments, so to make it easier for physicians to offer patients non-opioid options?
I don't know that others from HHS are on the call at present. I will say that we have had a series of discussions with CMS and other parts of HHS about this issue. We've heard the concern from both physicians and patient groups, and we're encouraged by the progress that we've seen in a variety of insurance programs of expanding the scope of the non-pharmacological treatments provided. Dr. Howery, do you want to say anything more about this?
I think these are just the next step. I think by showing CDC's views using the best available science on the need for non-opioids, the need for safe prescribing. This will help inform a lot of future changes. And as Dr. Frieden mentioned, we've been working closely with HHS agencies to really have a collaborative approach and making sure that we are able to provide this.
I'll close the telebriefing with a final comment about the guideline and its potential to reduce the epidemic we're living through of opioid overdose deaths. The prescription overdose epidemic is doctor-driven. It can be reversed in part by doctors' actions. The guideline doesn't replace clinical judgment, but it does provide a clear balance that has been missing. Prescription opioid overdose deaths can be prevented by improving prescribing practices. We can protect people from becoming addicted to opioids, and clinicians are key to helping reverse the epidemic. The management of chronic pain is both an art and a science, but the science of opioids for chronic pain is clear. For the vast majority of patients, the known, serious, and all too often fatal risks far outweigh the unproven and transient benefits, and there are safer alternatives. In medicine, we take an oath to, above all, do no harm. And for chronic pain, a doctor has to go to a pretty high bar to see that the likelihood of doing harm will not be greater than the likelihood of doing good. At the heart of the guideline is a conversation between clinicians and patients about the best, safest treatment for chronic pain with a full understanding of risks and benefits. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Frieden, and also thank you to Dr. Howery and Dr. Dowell for joining us today, as well as Secretary Burwell. Thank you also, reporters. For follow-up questions, please call the press office at 404-639-3286, or you can email us at media@cdc.gov. Thank you for joining us. This concludes today's briefing.
That does conclude today's conference call. We thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect and have a great rest of your day.